Welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmosh, and we're in episode 2 of our series with Dr. Birgit Schule. As always, I recommend listening to part 1 before this one. Today, we'll be discussing how Parkinson's research has advanced over the course of her 20-plus year career with a detour through what that means for scientific literature and recognition of individual contributions. So, welcome back, Birgit. Let's just jump right in.
Okay.
Has anything changed in our understanding of Parkinson's since you began working in the field that may have changed or dramatically changed your research focus or caused a shift of some sort, whether that was joining a different lab group or, as we spoke last time, a mentor relationship, something along those lines?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I thought about that a little bit. What has dramatically changed? I mean, not the goal in my scientific career to do something for patients with Parkinson's disease, develop therapies in the end. But what has changed is really the way we do science and the way technologies have advanced. So when I started in the field, we were really sequencing by hand. So we ran PCRs and ran it on gels and looked at bands. And I mean, it was really tedious 20 years ago. And that has changed so dramatically. So the speed and the amount of data that you get, not just for sequencing, but also for gene expression, everything that's related to omics. So that's a whole new field. And it's not just the technology, but also how you look at your data. And so from the omics in bulk, now we are at single cell resolution. And so that needs a lot more computational biology to look and tease out those things. So that's one thing that completely shifted from like a single assay to kind of gazillion data points.
If I can interrupt for a second, yeah. I hope that the general public has an understanding of that, because it is well discussed that information is of value, right? That, you know, Google is selling your information, all these other companies, maybe I shouldn't have said a name, but that the bulk data is worth more than any individual data point. And there's no reason that doesn't adapt to biology. That is an entire field of study in biology now. And so I'm personally very excited to follow this train of thought, because that's where I work.
Yeah. And it's hard for someone who started with kind of a single data point to shift. And that also has shifted the way we work together. I mean, 20 years ago, it was okay to have a lab, to run an electrophoresis, a Western blot, some stains. And so you could do your thing, you could publish papers, you could advance the field, but that's not possible anymore, because now it's a true interdisciplinary approach that you have to take. And not a single person, I thought about this morning, not a single person is the first author or the last author. So it's always the group. And I think we have to kind of also shift the way we think about recognition of those 20 or 40 or more authors on scientific papers and how we weight these contributions. So maybe there shouldn't be just a first author, but maybe there should be a first author of a particular area of that research, like the biology part or the computational part, so that the recognition is different. Because I mean, the people that are on these papers first in the upper part, those are the junior people that are launching their careers, and historically or traditionally, the computational biologists were more in the middle, a little hidden, yeah. And so those people need more recognition to get
agreed
to and the next level.
I don't know if the phrase has made it to your neck of the woods, but I've heard many a time that publications are the currency of science. And within that currency, as you're kind of alluding to, being the first author and the corresponding author, the final author, that has the most impactful value. But you're 100% right. I've published papers where the biologist did all of this stuff that I never could, and I was doing the computational aspects right. that presumably they weren't trained to do. And given that existing archetype of first or last, and the last usually goes to whomever's running the overall program, you know, the conceptualized aspect of it, how do you spread that recognition, especially, again, as you were saying, you know, the junior staff members need it more than someone who's got 20, 30 years tenure, but you also want to respect their contributions. And so, yeah, that paradigm needs a bit of a shift there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but it also brought other good things. What I also see is this shift from being in one lab, hiding your data, being a little cagey about it, to open science. So I've also witnessed and lived through that change. And it's fantastic, because only if we have open science and can share data in a good annotated way, not just data done somewhere.
It's always an important caveat.
then it makes it really impactful. And so then you don't have to repeat the same things over and over again, because in a way I felt like the field was stalling a little bit. And now with open science and sharing data and knowledge, I hope this also accelerates true discoveries that lead to new therapies. It's exciting, and I feel very privileged to kind of live through this kind of old way, and then coming to this new way. And again, a mentor of mine early on, Ute Franke, here in the genetics department, she understood this concept. And mm-hmm. so already during my postdoc, she said, "Oh, look at this this new journal. This is all open access." And I had never heard about this. And I thought, "Wow, okay." But yeah, I mean, that's what we have to do, and we have to share. But then again, I mean, as we talked about, people need recognition and these authorships to get to the next step in their career. And I see a lot of people struggling as well. So we have to find a balance.
Absolutely. I think it's one of the underspoken values of the internet to science, both the data sharing aspects, but also the open access journals. When magazine paper and ink and toner and distribution were all part of the costs of a journal, they needed to recover that funding. When it's just bytes on a computer, all of a sudden those costs start dropping. It makes sense that you can now publish a wider array of information. And it is hard to tell on the date of receiving a manuscript if that is going to be of massive importance, or if it's going to have that kind of long reaching impact. I mean, you need to see what time tells, right? Yeah.
And preprint servers. That's the other good thing that got into this world maybe a decade ago. Yeah. So BioArchive, MedArchive, mm-hmm. Just two examples. But that's pretty cool too. And basically all of our papers are put in preprints before they actually get published. So that means you can already disseminate all that information before you go through this really long, winding, sometimes peer review that can take years. So that's another good way.
For sure. I'd even argue that the preprint servers give you an advantage there, because you have an opportunity by virtue of BioArchive or MedArchive for someone who is not an editor on a journal, not on their editorial board, for somebody who's just interested, maybe they're an expert, maybe they're not, to read through your manuscript and provide their advice. And, there's always, I think, a potential for an unexpected collaboration there that wouldn't have happened yeah. through traditional means.
Yeah, but I also wanted to mention something else. So we talked about big data mm-hmm. and omics, single cell approaches. The other thing that even before that changed really kind of my research focus are these induced pluripotent stem cells that we mentioned. And induced pluripotent stem cells were discovered in 2006, 2007 by the Yamanaka group, and he received the Nobel Prize in Medicine for that. And that was really for my research a turning point, because before I would work with cell lines with in vitro models that were derived from human cancer. So those, most of them were human cancer cells, HeLa cells, HEX cells, all of those.
Immortalized by one means or another.
Right. Immortalized cell lines. Sometimes patient cell lines that were immortalized with viruses. But the problem there, and that's what I got back from reviews when I submitted grant proposals, were, well, yeah, you do this in vitro. However, this is not disease relevant, because the cancer cell line is not a dopaminergic neuron in the brain of a Parkinson's patient. Duh, well, that's obvious.
Right, and if you're talking about gene expression, that's a major factor.
Right. And so that's why my grants weren't reviewed that positively. But with this turning point of being able to turn a skin cell or a blood cell or basically any cell of the human body into an induced pluripotent stem cell, we had now a chance to then differentiate into the target tissue types of interest. And so, I mean, by now, people have probably made thousands, 10,000s of iPS lines from patients. And that really is changing also the way we do science. That combined with big data, single cell analysis, and now these more disease-relevant in vitro models. That is very, very powerful. And that has really shifted my research focus. Although I have to say, it's growing stem cells is not as easy as growing cancer cells. And differentiating induced pluripotent stem cells into a neuron can take weeks or months to have a cell type that's really relevant and not just immature and does something that you don't really know, but something that really shows protein aggregation and kind of disease biology, that takes time.
So yeah. I take it you have, you're building stocks of these simultaneously. It's not on an individual basis, is that right?
Yeah. So we have, of course, you're in the lab, you not just have one cell line, you have multiple clones from the same donor or from different mutations, things like that. It's also a lot more expensive to run these studies. it's for one, the time that you have to keep them in culture, but also these stem cells need really more enriched media with specialized small molecules and proteins. So it's very expensive to do that. The outcome is that we have really neurons that look like dopaminergic neurons that could also grow in the brains of patients. So that's really cool.
And your grant funding is getting easier.
Yeah, although
perhaps.
Yeah. Yes. So especially here in California, we still have the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. So they have funded a lot of my studies, and I'm very thankful for that funding.
Have you I don't know if this is going to make sense. Have you developed any kind of favoritism towards one of the cell lines or, cloning sets or stocks? Has any of them, had a more substantive impact?
Well, I mean, as you know, from our discussion, alpha-synuclein is my favorite gene. So I have, my favoritism is towards these cell lines that have copy number variants in the alpha-synuclein gene. But any other cell line is fine too. I mean, the other thing is also I have, since I've been taking these biopsies or blood draws myself, so I go into the clinic, I see the patient, I consent them. And so then I also have a personal contact with the donors. So it's not just a vial that I receive from the repository.
Not purely anonymous then. Okay.
Those cell lines, no, they're not anonymous. So yeah, no, I'm pretty biased towards that's why I have my people, they get they get vials with numbers. I'm biased. So I'm good with numbers, so every identifier, I know exactly who it is. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't analyze data.
So what is that like then, to be doing this research with that kind of personal connection? Especially, so you spoke last time about longitudinal studies. I take it then that you are doing these biopsies, these samplings, blood draws periodically over time. And does that mean that you're also watching the disease progression as far as the symptoms go?
Yes. So yeah, in the past I did that. For example, for this alpha-synuclein triplication patient, he would come once a year to the clinic and I would follow him over the years. That's one thing. Now here at Stanford, it's a little bit more separated. So there's the clinic and there's my lab. So I see them once in a while. Before I worked at a smaller nonprofit institute for Parkinson's disease, and everything was under one roof. So I was upstairs mm-hmm. in my office, downstairs was the lab, on the left side, on the right side was the clinic. So it was very easy to kind of have patient contact. And there I also did all the clinical workup. I took videos of the motor symptoms of patients. So yeah, so I had with a lot of these patients and families, a very close doctor-patient relationship. And that also kind of, probably has impacted my, the depth of what I'm doing here, and the purpose for what I'm doing here, because you see these patients and over time, and so there are it's more than just someone in the clinic where you're writing a prescription. So mm-hmm. I mean, you know, these families, these everything that's going on, and so you know you want to make a difference.
Yeah, that's got to be, I don't know, it's beautiful to me. In my work, I'm a puzzle solver. I work in microbial genomics. Everything is so deeply abstracted from any kind of connection. So for me, it's Sudoku on a daily basis. It's not, there is no relationship to the data I work with beyond how can I get something new out of this. So that seems like a unique connection you've got.
It's powerful, and it's also powerful for younger scientists and trainees. So whenever I have students in the lab, I'm asking them, do you want to come with me to the clinic and get to know someone with Parkinson's disease? And I mean, that has such an impact, and it's changing their whole perspective. It's really, I also see that when you go to conferences or meetings and there are patient advocates and patients talking about their disease, that is so powerful. Yeah, we have to do more of that. I mean, I'm also thinking here that maybe we can build some kind of buddy program, so where you have a patient and then have them together with researchers and really just go out for a coffee and talk about the disease, and the scientist talks about the science. And it's good in both ways, because patients that participate in clinical studies, they want to help, but they also mm-hmm. want hope that at some point there will be something that will help me. So right. you give back hope, and that's something it took a while for me to understand. So for the longest time, when we early on when we were trying to hunt for genes and mutations, I often had to come back and tell these patients, sorry, we didn't find anything. And it was very, very embarrassing for me because I felt like I failed. But in the end, someone would come to you as a patient and tells you, I tried really, really hard, and I will continue trying really hard to find the cause for your disease. That's so meaningful, and that gives patients so much hope. I had to learn that because, I mean, I have a confidence gap, so I always feel like I fail. But in a way, you don't. It's really the opposite. You always go back and you tell them, I'm trying, I'm here, I keep moving, I'm here to find the cause and a cure for people with Parkinson's disease. That's very, very powerful.
Yeah, and you know, even just the sentiment, we know it's not this, we're not going to waste our time in a treatment with this, we know it's not that, we know we're not going to waste our time, your time even. And as far as the buddy system goes, a patient and a doctor getting together for a coffee, or a patient and a researcher, a patient and a clinician, what have you, that sounds really appealing to me, like the diversity of perspectives. Right, because you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, the biologists and the comp scientists, the computational scientists, the concept leader on a paper, like they all come together, but the patient has an angle that nobody else could have.
Right.
Right. And no amount of expertise is going to be able to put you into those shoes. And it could just be a stray sentence one day over coffee that crystallizes something in your mind all of a sudden. I would be really curious to see how that would play out.
Exactly. And then as a scientist or a researcher or a clinician, you think, oh, someone is shaking or someone has, I don't know, change in their gait. We have to fix that. But maybe that's not the real problem. Right. That really bothers the patient. So I think that's something we have to find out, because it's such a Parkinson's disease has so many different symptoms that we have to really focus on what really matters when we try to mend the brain. So of course you want to fix everything, but maybe you can't do that all at once. And then maybe focusing on the more urgent problems. And I think maybe there it helps to actually, yeah, speak to someone who experiences that every day, 24/7.
Right. What better could you do? Thank you again. We are out of time for this segment, but we'll be back and we can take another breather. Dr. Birgit Schule has put herself in an incredible and unique position where she's capable of combining the versatility of induced pluripotent stem cells with the medical value of personally seeing to the treatment of some Parkinson's patients. The potential of personalized medicine is therefore close at heart in her lab. Next time, we'll be talking about Birgit's anticipation of the future within the field.